Okay. So, that's the last one. I'm still going to stand because there's people watching, so I'm going to do it this way. So we were doing some life lessons from the Haggadah, coming up to Pesach, preparing for Pesach. Sorry? Today's the last session. We're going to take a break for a few weeks.
A few weeks,
and we're going to start again, not the Thursday, just after Pesach, because,
we'll put it into practice.
Exactly. Very good.
A workshop.
Now, we're going to start again the new series, which I'll advertise the name of the new series. It's going to be an exciting series. The new one will be on the 9th of May, so Thursday, 9th of May is when we start again. Okay. So, this is the third week of doing this particular topic. So the first week we talked about gratitude. Last week we focused on step one of going out of our personal Egypt, reaching personal growth and freedom, and that is to believe that it's actually possible. Even if we feel that we've failed many times, even if we've lost hope, we can never define ourselves by our failures. And we talked about that concept of the sticks turning into the snake and then turning back, dipping the maror, the bitter herbs, into the charoset, which has the apple, a symbol of the strength of the Jewish people, and so on. Okay, so today, so we have to believe that it's possible, no matter how hopeless it seems. We can always grow. We can always have hope. We can always have a better tomorrow, a better today, better tomorrow, and so on. Today I'm going to talk about, so what's the strategy, right? What's the strategies for growth? What's the strategies to go out of our personal Egypt? So I'm going to share with you four ideas, four strategies, taken from the Pesach Seder, taken from the Seder experience. And hopefully, like I said last week, hopefully there's some insights that we're going to share today that you can even share at your own Seder to make it more meaningful and engaging. Before I do that, I want to just talk about, for a second, of course, the ability to grow Jewishly, spiritually, particularly comes from the energy of the Seder. The Seder is a very important and powerful experience. But like it always is in Judaism, how we connect to it is not just by thinking about it and talking about it and sharing insights. How we connect to it is by the performance of the rituals of the mitzvot on the night. And of particular importance is the mitzvah of eating matzah on the two nights of the Seder, right? Just to explain it halachically. The entire Pesach, there's no mitzvah to eat matzah. There's just a prohibition to eat chametz. So if you want to eat something, matzah will have to do, right? If you want to make hamotzi, if you want to eat some form of bread, it has to be matzah. But, sorry? You like matzah? Yeah, me too. Unfortunately. It's not very good for me, but I love it. So, but on the first two nights, actually a mitzvah to eat matzah, but the mitzvah is only accomplished, only achieved through eating shmura matzah. The first night. At least one big piece of shmura matzah. So, sorry?
I always get.
Yeah, you must get shmura matzah. So,
are you setting them?
I can arrange if you need, but you talk to me afterwards. But okay. Yeah. So if anyone doesn't have shmura matzah, please let me know. But
yes.
But it is available. You can get a Krinsky's, you can get a Kohl's even now, you can get a Gold's, you can get all over the place. Until it runs out. So probably not a good idea to wait too long. But the idea is that each person at the Seder should have what we call a kazayit, like a big piece. Roughly that's hand matzahs, about a third of a matzah. On the first night, and to eat it like quickly, to eat it like within a certain time frame. That's how you do the mitzvah, right? So when you wash for the meal and you eat matzah, get that mitzvah accomplished and get the mitzvah done, so you eat a big piece of shmura matzah on the first night of Pesach. Incidentally, I just want to mention something else we aren't aware of, because someone said to me something yesterday, which is interesting. They said, you know, those who suffer from gluten intolerance or celiac, nowadays you can buy gluten-free matzah. No, but the gluten-free matzah in the stores is not matzah. It's not made of wheat. It's not made of oats. So what you need to do if you're gluten intolerance, well, if you're not celiac, just a little bit gluten intolerance, then the best thing is to eat spelt shmura matzah, which is low, very low in gluten. However, someone who's celiac can't have any gluten. They do sell, I have a few pieces for people that need, to eat a piece of oat matzah. You see, the matzah needs to be made from 5 grains. 1 of 5 grains. Wheat, barley, spelt, rye, and oats, right? So you can't make really barley and and all of them have gluten anyway, but spelt is a bit healthier than wheat, but you can get oat matzah. It tastes terrible. Not that, no, seriously, it does. But it's a mitzvah. So if someone is celiac, if you know anyone that's celiac, and they can contact me, I'll give them a piece of matzah to eat from the oat matzah, especially the first night, and be able to do the mitzvah. Okay. So, four strategies for the ability to really grow, free ourselves from ourselves, go beyond ourselves, and so on. The first is the importance of having passion, right? Apathy prevents growth. That's just the way it is. A person can't grow. And apathy is really, even, you know, apathy is a real weak problem, because apathy often means, apathy, which leads to cynicism, often means that a person is just cold, apathetic, and sometimes it's to a point that a person has almost like made a decision that nothing's going to move them. You know, this is where it is. Don't tell me nice stories. Don't give me beautiful experiences. I'm not going to be inspired. That's like the ultimate of apathy. And if a person is apathetic, that's impossible then to actually grow. Grow requires life. It requires passion. It requires determination in order to be able to go beyond ourselves, to do the next thing, to step up our spiritual journey, right? So it's an interesting thing. I'll just share with you two ideas with this, that we know that when, you know, we say at the Seder, we recount the 10 plagues, yeah? Which the 10 plagues were given to the Jewish people. We talk about them because it's part of the miraculous nature of the process of going out of Egypt. It was an amazing, I mean, each plague was a miracle in its own right, and we are taught we have to retell the miracles that God did for us and so on, so we tell the 10 plagues. But 10 plagues are often misunderstood in the following way. They're often misunderstood that the entire purpose of the 10 plagues was just to dismantle the infrastructure of Egypt. Right? It was there to take away the ability of Egypt to be able to oppress us, right? And eventually force them to free us. But actually the Zohar and other Kabbalistic works explain that's not true. Meaning it was for that, true. It was to punish the Egyptians and to dismantle their whole regime and infrastructure and so on. But it was actually also also provided steps of redemption for the Jewish people. Each plague had a dual purpose, right? In other words, each plague carries a lesson and carries an energy which would help then the spiritual exodus. In other words, spiritual exodus took time, it took steps, it took many steps to go to be able to do that. Although there was a defining moment of redemption, but the concept, the journey of spiritual liberation and inner revelation takes time. And therefore, it needs the different lessons from the different plagues. So I'll share with you two lessons, one from the plague of blood, one from the plague of hail. So the first plague, you know, was the plague of blood. Essentially that God transformed the water of the Nile, which was the source of water for the Egyptians, into blood, right? So that was obviously a huge blow. Without blood, without water, you can't really exist. And it was a huge problem, right? After a few days, the Egyptians saw they can't do this. And they asked Moses to ask God to take away the plague, and they'll send the Jewish people, which they promised multiple times. Of course, they didn't do it. Okay. However, that plague of blood was also for the Jewish people. Not that they suffered the plague, but the concept of the plague was there for the Jewish people to learn a lesson. And what is that? It was the getting rid of the apathy. You know that blood is a symbol, in a positive sense, blood is a symbol of life, right? Our life energy is in the blood. There's a verse in Tanakh that says, "Ki hadam hu hanefesh." Blood is the nefesh. It's the soul of the person. Vibrancy, passion, warmth is all in the blood, right? Like, you know, you say a person is a very excitable person, you say they're a hot-blooded person, right? Because blood is what gives us life. When you lose blood, you become white, you become faint, yeah? So, and water is actually much more of a calm, cold sort of thing, which has its own benefits, but also can, in a negative way, can represent apathy. And therefore, God sent the first plague in the journey of redemption, the journey of liberation. He sent the first plague to teach us a lesson that the first thing that needs to be done is to develop passion. Now, what does that mean? But it's very hard to develop passion when you're not passionate, right? In other words, if a person is passionate, it's just difficult to do things, but at least he's passionate, so the passion builds a certain confidence and builds a certain determination, right? If you're not, that's a problem. So I guess the concept is that when you know that you have to go out of your own prison, out of your own mitzrayim, but you know that you have to, but you know you're also very apathetic, It's making that conscious decision and conscious resolution to let yourself be inspired, right? And then it becomes the collective responsibility of each of us to inspire each other, right? So to allow ourselves to be inspired, to allow ourselves, we hear something inspirational, to be inspired, to move, allow ourselves to get excited. There's another concept about the seventh plague, interesting plague. The seventh plague was hailstones, right? Hailstones rained down, destroying Egyptian crops, damaging their fields, and so on. But the Torah adds a very interesting detail into the plague of hailstones. This, by the way, they were very big hailstones, we are told, right? It was very dangerous for the Egyptians and so on. That the Torah says that each hailstone had a flame of fire burning inside the hailstone, which is obviously a miraculous thing because it's fire and ice don't really go together and so on. The question is, what was the purpose? Like, what for, right? We understand the hailstones. Hailstones were there to knock down the trees, the Egyptian trees, to kill the animals, to really, you know, make them uncomfortable. What was the point of the flame burning within the hailstone? There's a concept brought down in the very early Jewish sources that God doesn't do miracles for no purpose. He created a world which is supposed to run according to the natural sequence of things. We have miracles. Egypt was a miracle, right? The whole going out of Egypt was a miracle. But God doesn't do miracles if they have no purpose. So what was the purpose of fire burning within that ice, right? So again, same concept. The plagues are not just to dismantle Egypt. The plagues were also lessons for the Jewish people. And one of the ideas goes as following, that hail is cold. Hail is cold and icy, which can symbolize apathy, indifference, insensitivity sometimes, and so on and so forth, right? It's very hard when you like a hailstone, like an ice, it's very hard to be compassionate, it's very hard to love, it's very hard to be excited about things. So how does one spark that love, right? How does that spark that excitement? So the Torah tells us that we need to be aware that when we think that we're a hailstone, we think we're just a piece of ice, right? That every person, no matter how cold they might be, no matter how apathetic they might be, there's always a flame burning within, which is not apathetic, which is warm, which is excitable, which is passionate, which is compassionate, right? So the fire burns, but it's hidden inside. So what we need to do is we need to chip away at that ice, dissolve the ice, to reveal the passion. So the good news is that when we talk about the importance of passion in the journey of Exodus, personal freedom, when we think we've lost the passion, the Torah tells us with the plague of ice that we actually haven't. We appear to be a hailstone, but we're not. We just have to dissolve the hail, and then inside there's that flame of the flame. Okay. That's the first idea. Sorry?
When the hail turns into water, what? Squash the flame.
No, the whole thing was a miracle, right?
Because it's a miracle.
Yes, a miracle.
Oh, okay.
And I guess one of the lessons of the plagues is that we're also a miracle. Our existence is miraculous. That in itself, that when we become a hailstone, we don't destroy the fire within us, that's a miracle. Right? The fact that the fire continues to burn, always, just might be hidden. Okay. Now, the second ingredient to personal freedom is comes from a phrase in the Haggadah. I think I even put the phrase there. Tse'ulamad, I think so. So there's one of the paragraphs that where in the beginning of the Haggadah, we ask the Manishtana, we talk about the four sons. There's like a couple of introductory things that we say. And then, if you read the middle bulk part of the Haggadah, that's the story of Mitzrayim. And it culminates with the 10 plagues, right? There's a whole bunch of pages where we just tell the story. That story that we tell begins with a paragraph that begins with the following expression. The expression is, Tse ulamad. Go out and learn. And it starts with, we have to go back to the time of Lavan, Jacob's father-in-law, that he tried to destroy him, and then eventually Jacob went down to Egypt, and so on and so forth. But it starts with this expression of Tse ulamad. Go out and learn. Right? And the commentaries pick up on this. What kind of expression is this, go out and learn? You normally tell a person, come and learn. That's what I do anyway. I tell people to come and learn, right? Right, so the idea is, the Mefarshim, the commentaries explain that what the Haggadah is teaching us is that if you want to say the Haggadah, you want to experience the Haggadah, you want to experience the going out of your own personal Egypt, you have to be committed, you have to resolve that you're going to go out of yourself. You're going to do something that's hard for you. You're going to go beyond yourself, right? Where else do we find this expression of tse, of go out? So we once spoke about this, I think. Where God told Abraham, when he promised him children, right? He told him to go and count the stars, and he said that all your descendants will be as many as the stars, right? But in the Chumash, when God tells Abraham to do that, he also uses the word tse. He said, tse hachutza, go outside. Go outside and look at the stars and count them, right? So the commentary explained, what else? That's an interesting expression. I mean, if God would tell Abraham, look at the stars, there's no extra word in the Torah, right? So if you would tell him, just look at the stars, and Abraham happened to be in his living room, I mean, it would be obvious that he has to go outside because you can't see the stars in the living room, so you've got to go outside, right? Or his tent, whatever it was then. But, so why did God have to say, tse hachutza? So Rashi comments and he says something beautiful, that when Abraham was telling, why was Abraham so worried about not having children? Right? I mean, apart from the fact that he was getting on in years, but also he was very upset and he was very concerned that he wasn't going to have any children. Why? Because Abraham was an astrologer. That's what we are taught. He was very well versed in the stars and the signs of the stars and all these things, that the messages that if you look at the stars properly, you can understand what is going to happen. And he understood by looking at the stars that he's actually not going to have children. Right? He's not going to have children. And God tells him, this is what Rashi tells us, God tells him, tse hachutza, go out, meaning go out of your astrology, go beyond your what you think is the obvious. Yes, it is true, what you have seen is correct, what you have seen is accurate, but it's in the realm of nature, it's in how this world works. But you're not bound by nature. We're not bound by nature. The Jewish people have never been bound by nature. In fact, the child that Abraham was going to have, which was going to be the continuation of the Jewish story, beginning with Abraham and then Yitzchak and then Yaakov and the Jewish nation, had to be in such a way where the child that was born to him was supernatural. Because he was giving birth to a nation that's supernatural. Right? And that's why God says to him, say, you got to go out. You got to go out. Understand what you've seen in the stars, but that's not you. That is nature. That is the laws of nature. We are not bound by nature. Which history, by the way, has taught us very clearly. That as a Jewish nation, we are not bound by nature at all. Because following the natural study of statistics, we shouldn't be here. Right? We know that all the big empires that tried to destroy us have come and gone. They're not here anymore. The other ones in their place, unfortunately, but they're not here. We are, right? And we shouldn't. Statistically, we shouldn't be here.
That's it. Does the Torah say anything about
the world being destroyed? The world's not going anywhere. I promise you, the world's fine. No, we are taught to take care of the planet and look after Hashem's world and so on. But there's no what's the word for it? Apocalyptic vision in Judaism. That's complete nonsense. We know that the world is no. I'm not saying we should be wasteful and all that. We should be reasonable. But we believe in the ultimate coming of Mashiach. We believe that there will be another Exodus other than Pesach, which is the, and we believe that we are here for eternity. The Jewish people are here for eternity, and the world is not disintegrating.
Thank you.
Promise you. Therefore, God is telling Abraham, go out of yourself. Now, you're giving birth to a nation that's supernatural. The thing is this, right? That we understand that collectively. We understand that the physical existence, at least of the Jewish people, and the spiritual existence of the Jewish people is eternal. It's miraculous. But what we don't often apply and understand, that we are supernatural as individuals. Right? In other words, we have that concept that we are able to go beyond our own nature. We all have a nature. We all have a personality. We all have a set of traits, a set of skills, a set of weaknesses, a set of strengths. Personality strengths, personality weaknesses, right? And sometimes to grow is very difficult. Yes, it is difficult, it's true. But we can do it. Because to say, and that's what Agadah says, you wanna go out of Egypt? You wanna experience, you wanna tell the story to experience the story? Say ulamad. You're gonna have to go out of yourself to learn something new and to then apply that something new. That's a word, key word, say. Look for it in Haggadah. Say ulamad. All right? And that's the whole purpose. The whole purpose of existence is to grow, is to go beyond ourselves, is to free ourselves from ourselves. You know what's an amazing thing? 7 weeks later, after the Jews went out of Egypt, right? All the Jewish people and all the future souls stood at Mount Sinai for the most amazing and defining moment of the Jewish history, and to receive the Torah when we completed the process of becoming God's nation, right? And it was a very amazing moment, and God revealed himself and so on. And he communicated the Ten Commandments. What's the first of the Ten Commandments? Anyone else? I'm Elohim. Anachi Hashem Elokecha, right? Which is really the mitzvah of believing in God. Because before we start anything about connection to God, you've got to believe in Him, right? So Anachi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem your God. How does the sentence continue? Asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, that I took you out of Egypt. Yeah. So the commentaries ask the question, that's a really strange thing to say. If God wanted to declare and sort of give his credentials, he should have said, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am God, your God. Asher barati shamayim v'aretz, I created the world, I created the universe. Right? And the answer is that God was saying no. I'm revealing myself to you. I'm making you my nation. I'm giving you the Jewish destiny, the Jewish eternity. I don't need to prove myself. I'm telling you your mission. And your mission is not to believe in me because I created heaven and earth. Heaven and earth is nature. That's how the world runs. I want you to believe in me because Asher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim, I took you out of Egypt. And you have to go out of your Egypt. The whole purpose of Matan Torah is in every generation, every day, every year at Pesach, to go out of Egypt again. That's the purpose. That's why I'm revealing myself to you. That's why I'm making you my nation at Har Sinai. Because the purpose of your existence is to continuously grow. Continuously make progress. Go out of yourself. Go beyond your nature like Avraham Avinu. I told Avraham Avinu, Tzei Achutza, go outside. I took you out of Egypt. Going out of Egypt means that you also have your own Egypt, which means you have to go out of Egypt. Right? You have to go out of yourself. Now, many years ago, I said this many times. Maybe I'll just do a revision. I told you the midnight idea. You remember the midnight idea? Anyone remember? No? Okay, so I can do it again. So we know an interesting thing, just to show you how this works, that God told Moses that the defining, like there's the Maharal of Prague talks about this a lot. The Jews, when they were in Egypt, were not only in Egypt physically, right? This is the whole concept of Pesach. But we were in Egypt spiritually. Not only were they in Egypt spiritually, but all our souls were, right? In other words, before Pesach, before Yitzhak Mitzrayim, before we went out of Egypt, we were all our souls were somewhat prisoned. We didn't have the concept of true freedom, right? When I say freedom, of course, freedom doesn't mean freedom to do what you want. It means freedom to do the right thing, freedom to grow, freedom to go beyond ourselves and so on, right? But the Zohar says, and many places it talks about this idea, that there was a defining moment of freedom. Like, if you had to ask the question, when did we become free? Like, when were our souls released, so to speak, right? When were we given the gift of freedom, when our souls became free? Because, you know, I just want to explain this a little bit. When the Maharal of Prague explains this as well, that when we became free in Egypt, that freedom was eternal. Because a question is asked, you know, we became free, but we went back into exile. So we were under the Egyptians, but then later on, after the first temple, we were under the Babylonians, then under the Persians, and then under the Greeks, and then under the Edomites, and under other people, right, and so on and so forth. But that's what we mean by freedom. The difference, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt gave us a gift of eternal freedom that has never been taken away. We became essentially free. The way to explain that is that in all future slaveries, in all future exiles, our bodies went into exiles, but our soul never went into exiles. Our soul remains free. And that's why even though when we're in exile, or even though it's challenging time and so on, we retain that gift of being able to reveal our soul and to become truly free, right? That's why we keep, you know, it's like Viktor Frankl wrote with regard to the concentration camp. He said he experienced the idea of freedom there, right? In the most adverse of situations, he said they can take whatever they want from me, they can take my dignity away from me, but they can't. They can't take me away from me, right? They can't. I remain essentially free. That's his whole thesis. And that freedom then, he goes on to explain, comes from the pursuit of meaning and purpose, right? So when was the defining moment of freedom? Midnight. again, going back to the Zohar we said before, the Zohar says that with the final plague, which God said would take place at midnight, right? Midnight after the night before they left Egypt, they left in the morning, that will be the final blow to Egypt and the final gift to the Jewish people. So when the Makat Bechorot, when the plague of the firstborn was taking place, we were becoming free. We were being given the gift of freedom. And there's a tremendous emphasis in the Torah about that it had to take place at midnight. Right? And the question is, what's the greatness of midnight? Why midnight? Right? Now, to strengthen the question, everything in the Torah is true, correct? So every word is counted out, every word is authentic and true. Which means, therefore, that makes the expression of midnight even more problematic. Because, if listen carefully to this one, midnight doesn't actually exist. Did you know that? No such thing as midnight. We borrow the term. Let me explain to you. Just like it works in space also. It's true. Look at this. Take this paper, right? How about if I tell you that I want you to show me the exact middle of this paper? Right? There's no such thing. I can make a line or I can make a fold, right? Yeah? Okay, I'll make a fold. And then you can say it's the middle. It's not. Why? Because this paper has two sides, right? This side and this side. When this side finishes, the next side's already begun. And if I can break this down, it just looks like the middle, but I can break it into millions of particles. And every particle either belongs to the first half of the page or the second half of the page. There's no middle. You get me? No, but there is no. It's fact. It's scientifically accurate. There's no such thing as the middle of the page. Same thing with time. Time is constantly moving, correct? Time doesn't stand still. So there's the first half of the night and the second half of the night, right? The last moment of the first half of the night begins really the moment of the next half of the night. There's no such thing as midnight.
Right?
No such thing as midday. No such thing. It doesn't exist. It either belongs to the first half or the second half. No such thing as the middle.
Isn't it the darkest point and from them comes light? So
no, you think of something else. You think of the end of the night. Before dawn, it's the darkest point. And then that emerges into dawn. That's a different concept. Yeah. So how could the Torah say Chatzot that the midnight will take place, at the Geula, the redemption, the gift of freedom will be given at midnight? Right? You can challenge everyone around your Seder. You can ask them about midnight. See if you'll get pushback. Because when I say that, everyone says, well, of course it's midnight. So midnight is what we call it a borrowed term. In other words, yeah, when the clock strikes 12, it's midnight. But as soon as you say it's midnight, it's already past 12. In other words, it's not such a thing. It's the middle of that. Okay. The answer is following. Listen carefully. It's an amazing thing. There's what we call creation, like what I said before, nature. And then there's the transcending of nature, right? One of the things, the way God created the world, is that everything has a definition, right? A chair has a definition, a table. Animals have a definition. There's a personality trait of every animal. A sheep is different to a cow, different to a bird, right? Okay. Because part of the definition of creation is that everything has a definition. And the definitions don't mix. Like you can't take a cat and turn it into a dog. It doesn't work, right? You can modify. You can train a cat. You know, there's a famous story of the Rambam. I don't know if I've ever told you the story. There's a famous story of Maimonides, who was a great philosopher as well. And the philosophers of his time said that you can intrinsically change an animal. And the Rambam says you can't. You can train an animal. Like you can make them do things, but you can't intrinsically change it. Impossible. So they made a bet. What's that? Yeah, a little bit. Like the personality of something, you can't change it. It is what it is. So they said, okay, give us 6 months, we'll prove you wrong. So they took a cat and they trained it to be a waitress. Properly, like fully trained. I mean, you know, today they train animals to do amazing things, right? And then they called the Rambam and they made this big banquet. And they're going to prove the Rambam wrong. So there was a room, and then suddenly a cat comes in, has an apron, lays the table, brings the drinks out. Oh, beautiful, right? And they And they say, oh, everyone's getting excited, the Rambam is going to be proven wrong. In those days, it was cool to prove a Jew wrong anyway, and the Rambam's sitting there very comfortable. He's fine with the whole thing. He's smiling, he's okay. And they're like, I can't understand, how come he's not getting upset? So he waits for the moment where the cat brings out this hot tray of food. At that moment, he takes a mouse out of his pocket and releases it to the thing. Suddenly, the whole food goes smashing down. The cat's running after the mouse. That's it. You can't change a cat. The cat is a cat. Now, we know that with human beings, a bit like that also, right? Because we have certain personalities. Like, we've talked a lot about Chesed and Gevurah, for example, right? Chesed and Gevurah are the two primary foundational emotions that a person has. And most people have a personality. Some people are more towards Chesed, some people are more towards Gevurah, right? Not good or bad, just that's their personality. They all come with good things and bad things, but that's personality. And people often think that it's hard to change. This is who I am. I'm a Chesed person, I'm a Gevurah person, and I can't change, right? Now, Kabbalah tells us, right? Kabbalah tells us that during the night, the first half of the night is Gevurah, and the second half of the night is Chesed. So that's what we're talking about. That's for another discussion. It's not to understand what that means, but that's what we're talking about. And in this world, it's either Chesed or Gevurah. Like, it's either the first half of the night or the second half of the night. As I said before, there's no midnight. It's either Chesed or Gevurah. However, when God took us out of Egypt, He gave us a gift of transcendence. He gave us the gift of freedom. The gift of freedom means that we suddenly, and this is only given to the human being, that we are given the gift of freedom that unlike animals, and even unlike angels, are also unable to change their personality because they're holy and perfect, but they're not able to change who they are. We are, because we were given the neshama, we're given the soul. The soul was released from prison. The soul has an infusion of godliness. God Himself is infinite and transcendent and not bound by the laws of nature or the laws of definition. The only definition you can give about God is that He's undefined, right? Because He's infinite, truly infinite. And therefore, we have a little bit of a piece of God, so to speak, within us, and we are able to do that. We are able to be undefined. So if we're a chesed person, we're able to transcend our chesed and gevurah. Right? We might have a personality. Of course we were given a personality, but we are not bound by it. And therefore, if the call of the hour is to do something which calls for a totally different personality, we are able to do that. That's what freedom means. That we're not locked into who we are. And that is midnight. In this world, midnight doesn't exist. But in God's world, it does. Because what is that idea of midnight? It's the idea that is neither chesed nor gevurah because it transcends both. That's what midnight is. It doesn't exist in this world. This world is a world of definitions. But God said, when I'm going to redeem the Jewish people, I'm going to redeem them at midnight. I'm going to give them the gift of midnight. I'm going to take them out at midnight when I'm going to raise them above the first half of the night and the second half of the night. It won't be the first half or the second half. It's midnight. Because it's, in God's world, it is midnight. It's something that transcends both chesed and gevurah. In this world, when the first half of the night ends, the second half of the night right away begins. It's either chesed or gevurah. This world needs definitions. But a human being, after Yetziat Mitzrayim, we are able to rise above that. We're able to be transcendent. And that's what it's say all about. In order to really experience freedom, it's not about just about doing some nice things and becoming a little bit of a better person. We have to totally go beyond ourselves. We have to do things that are difficult for us. We have to be willing to do things that are not according to our personality, to transcend that personality. The chesed person must be willing to do gevurah things. The gevurah person must be willing to do chesed things, because that's what true growth is. Say ulamad, go out and learn. Go out of yourself. And we can do that because that is the true gift of freedom. Number three. So we've got to build passion and we've got to be willing to go beyond ourselves. However, number three tells us, that's all good, but if you want to go out of yourself, that's very hard. And you've got to be willing to work hard. Which is something that today's society doesn't like very much. Just, right? We have everything coming to us, and this idea of really working hard is like almost a creative idea today, right? Because to really go out of Mitzrayim, we have to be ready to work very, very hard. I'll just show you an idea. I once wrote an article on this, but there was a very interesting idea. Because willing to put in the effort means we're willing to go beyond ourselves, and that means we're willing to not be locked in our own ego, right? So we eat matzah, right? We have to eat matzah. Now matzah we know cannot be chametz. Chametz is a no-no on Pesach, which means that the dough that we make cannot rise even a little bit, right? So we know that there's a famous halacha. If you make flour and water come into contact with each other, how long do you have for the matzah to be baked? 18 minutes, right? 18 minutes. That's why if you go to a matzah bakery, particularly a hand-baked matzah bakery, you'll see it's baked very quickly, and it was always rushing, and there's cycles, they go in cycles of 18 minutes. Sometimes they're able to make multiple matzahs within 18 minutes, and then all of a sudden the bell goes, and they stop, they have to re-clean everything, and start again. Wash their hands, right? Because it's been 18 minutes now, so the flour and water is going to rise, so therefore you've got to... Okay. That's it, you've got 18 minutes for it to become a matzah, otherwise you've got to throw it away. However, there's another halacha, another law, a lesser known one, right? And that is that this thing that within 18 minutes the dough will start to rise, that's only if you leave the dough sitting. But if you're kneading a dough, right, and you keep kneading it and you keep kneading it, let's say the oven wasn't ready, but you keep working with the dough, you don't have to worry about the 18 minutes. It can keep going. As long as you keep working the dough, it won't become chametz. Now, today they don't do that because we're very strict the way we make matzahs, and you know we're not taking any chances and so on, and therefore we don't practically apply this halacha because any matzah baker would never do that, and they always stop at 18 minutes no matter what they're doing with the dough. But technically speaking, if you're working with the dough, you don't have to worry about it, right? So there's an amazing lesson in this, right? We are not perfect people. We have an ego. And that's part of why chametz is a problem. Because we are taught on Pesach that if you want to go out of Mitzrayim, you have to leave your ego on the side, because ego is what traps you. Ego is what holds you back. Right? And therefore, we have to make sure the dough doesn't rise. However, the halacha says if you keep working the dough, in other words, if you're willing to work hard, that's a sign that your ego is taken care of. If you're willing to put in the effort to do things that are hard. And that's why that's the lesson, that when you work hard, you make sure the ego doesn't interfere. And therefore, the dough doesn't become chametz. And working hard is under the recognition, right, that life is a struggle. It's not easy to go out of our Egypt. It's not easy to go to grow. Because we have two parts of our personality, we know this, where we do have an ego. And to overcome that ego takes a lot of work, right? I'll tell you an interesting thing. You know, with matzah, so we were talking about this before, right? What can you make matzah out of? You can make matzah out of five things, five grains, right? Wheat, barley, rye, spelt, and oats. That to do the mitzvah, that's considered matzah, right? Why those five grains?
What they use today.
Sorry?
Is that what they use today?
They use wheat mainly. Spelt matzah has become pretty popular. And oat matzah they make only for the celiacs because it doesn't taste very good. Right? It tastes worse than other matzah, put it that way. Right? So, and I don't think you can make good bread out of barley and rice, or maybe rye you could, but rye you can, but it's full of gluten and it's no point.
So they wholemeal matzah.
Yeah, wholemeal is wheat still. It's just wholemeal. It's wholemeal. Yeah. Okay, so matzah must be made of one of those five grains. Why? Why can't we take another grain? Why can't we have? I mean, today you can make very good breads out of rice. You make flour, lots of things, right? but pre-kidneyot, let's say, right? What kidneyot is a more recent prohibition, but we're saying, right? Potato starch, I mean, you can make bread lots of things, why not, right? Which, by the way, exactly is what gluten-free matzah is, the standard gluten-free matzah is made out of, right? That's why it's no good for Pesach, Pesach night, right? Why? Because the halacha is, matzah is something that shouldn't rise, correct? But it's got to be made out of something that could rise. Understand? A flour that comes from a grain that will ferment that way. Which is why, by the way, you know something called egg matzah? Have you seen it? It's called matzah shir. Right? I mean, the Ashkenazi custom is not to eat it on Pesach, but technically it's okay. But you can't fulfill the mitzvah with egg matzah. Why? One of the reasons is because if you make to rise, you need a grain, one of the five grains, and it's got to be with water. Right? If you make a matzah with fruit juice, for example, or eggs, it won't rise. Rising means it won't ferment. I mean, you can get a big bread out of it, but it won't ferment in that way, right? Matzah has to be made out of a dough that if you leave it and you don't bake it right away, it will rise. Why? Why is it so important? Why can't we make it out of a grain that doesn't rise ever, and then we'll have to take our time? The reason is because that's the whole point. The point is to experience the idea of matzah with the recognition that we have an ego. We should have to take care of it, right? The grains that don't rise don't have an ego. In other words, they don't have that concept of representing an ego. In other words, we have to recognize the struggle. God gave us a struggle, that by design. He gave us an internal struggle between our animal self and our godly self. He gave us that struggle between our ego and our selflessness. And it's a hard war. We have to recognize that. But achieving the giving up of the ego is about, that's what matzah is all about. It's about letting the ego go, right? But it's only kosher if you understand that struggle. Although you have to make it from something that can potentially go wrong, recognizing that it's a struggle. And therefore you can only make it one of those five grains because you have to have the chametz and then the matzah. Okay, finally. The most important thing of the Pesach experience is immediate implementation, right? We know it's a very nice idea. All these ideas are very cute and very nice, hopefully inspirational. We sit down to the Seder, hopefully we make the Seder an inspirational experience. But then really when it comes Pesach, we actually have to ask ourselves a question. What are we going to do about it? Concept is good, growth, we've got to be there. It's not enough just to sit there and resolve, you know, I think I'm going to try and grow this year, right? I'm going to grow beyond myself. You know, there's research with teacher training. In education, there's research that teachers who go to a brilliant in-service day or teacher training, staff development day, and the presenter gives wonderful ideas, wonderful educational ideas, if any idea that's not implemented within 48 hours never gets implemented. Yeah. Just doesn't happen, right? It's got to be immediately implemented. Where do we see this in the Seder? We see the interesting thing right in the very beginning. You know how we do the Kadesh Urechatz, right? So that's the mnemonic, right? That's the signs of the Seder. But Kadesh is a sort of a spiritual experience. We make Kiddush. It's about giving sanctity to the day, right? Urechatz is we go wash our hands without the blessing, right? Now, if you look at the Kadesh Urechatz, you'll notice that there's no, except for this exception, there's no and. Like, you know, you have Kadesh, like you have something, Motzi, Matzah, Maror, Korech, right? Karpas, Yachatz, Karpas means the vegetable, Yachatz means, it doesn't say Karpas u Yachatz. It doesn't say Karpas and Yachatz. And then say the Haggadah, and then go wash, right? Only one of them, the first washing, because Kadesh, Urchatz, and go wash. And wash. But there's an and there. Right? Yeah, you follow what I'm saying? There's no and in any of the others. Now, there's a simple reason for that. Because the way Kadesh Urechatz was made is that every word has to have two syllables. Like Kadesh. Motzi, Matzah. Right? Magid, Karpas. The word Rechatz is only one. So Rechatz, it's only one syllable. So made it Urchatz, Urchatz, right? And there is, I heard this my grandfather, there were old Haggadot that had a different version, and instead of saying Urchatz, it said Rachatz. If you have the right vowel, you can turn it into two syllables, Rachatz, right? Okay. But there's a spiritual thing. But in general, everything in the Seder has a lot of spiritual significance. Even something like Kadesh Urchatz just seems like a nice sign to keep organized. Like a to-do list, but actually it has, you know, it's 15 words, the name of God is 15, Yud and Hey, a lot of stuff behind it. One of the ideas of having the Vav there in Urechatz is it connects it to the Kaddish. In other words, Kaddish means you declare the inspiration of the night, you declare the sanctity, the holiness of the night. And then you say, but listen, Chavre, this is all not good unless there's immediate implementation. Got to go do something about it. Urechatz, and right away, and means it connects it to the Kaddish. Don't wait. Kadesh Urchatz, now go and wash, do something about it. Right? Demonstrate your implementation of the holiness of the night. And that's why I think it's really important when it comes to Pesach, and I think especially this year, right? I'd like to highlight that maybe just in 4 minutes. I mean, hopefully it'll be a miracle before Pesach, but God forbid if there isn't, we need to bear in mind that there's lots of people not able to celebrate a Pesach. The hostages, the injured, even the soldiers. You know, there are many soldiers who will not sit down to a proper Seder, right? Because they'll be stuck somewhere in a tank, right? And I think that's, and in general, I think just is a good time to wake up. Like, you know, as things go on, it's 6 months already, and as things travel on, we get complacent. You know, we kind of like once in a while say something nice and give a krechts, but we go on our regular life, right? And I think maybe one of the things we need to do this week, this Pesach, is to actually have a think about doing something tachlis, doing something different. Maybe taking upon ourselves, I mean, I've done this personally, I'm not going to share with you what it is, but I think I'm going to make like something hard that maybe we should take on and do and accept, because
what?
I'll give you a couple of examples if you, right? If you, no problem. But I want to just highlight the importance of doing something. I'll tell you an amazing little insight, a little story. In the 70s, right, when there was the whole plight of the Jews in Russia, right, that was a very highlighted story. So the Jewish Federation, I'm sure you know this, the Jewish Federation of North America decided to launch a campaign. The campaign was they wanted to bring it more to the consciousness of people. So they asked everyone to put an empty chair by the Seder, an additional chair. I'm sure you've heard of this, right? For the people in Russia. So they went to different leaders, and they went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. By that time, Lubavitcher Rebbe, I mean, he became the Rebbe in 1950. So in the 70s, he was already very well known, very influential. They came to him getting his one day support. This is very typical of the Rebbe, by the way. So he said to them the following. He said, your idea of adding a chair is very important, and I'm ready to join the call on one condition. That the chair doesn't remain empty. Fill it up with someone. Go find, you know, the Rebbe couldn't stand this symbolic ideas. Right? Actually, he was very against the empty chair. Because he says, adding a chair, I'm not against. And look, it's a good idea. Add another chair to your Seder, but go find someone to fill it up. Right? Maybe someone that, you know, he used to talk about, I mean, I'll give you other examples also, but I'm just saying, just the idea of a symbol that's just symbolic is another theoretical thing. It's not change. Right? In Judaism, the emphasis on like mitzvah, doing things, action, right? So I'm saying about filling up the chair, you know, the Rebbe had this very, very famous concept. Everyone talks about it, but it was originally one of his talks where the Haggadah tells us that there's five sons, right? The wise son, the wicked son, the simple son, and the one who can't even ask any questions. And the Rebbe came up with this real idea that there's a fifth son, right? Because he said, even the wicked son, he's challenging, he's very challenging, but he's at the Seder. He said, how many children are there that are not at the Seder? Right, the fifth son, they don't even know that it's Pesach. He says, go find the fifth son. Right? Go find a fifth son. Unfortunately, they exist. Go find them. Right? But I was thinking, you talk about examples, right? So first of all, it's about also being careful at the Seder to do, like, the Shmur Matzah is a good example. Like, make sure to eat Shmur Matzah and a big piece and do it properly, halachically, so we'd actually give the mitzvah. But I was thinking about mitzvot that people could engage in. That might be a little bit challenging, might be a little bit difficult, but this is what Pesach is all about, and maybe we should do it. Maybe this Pesach, we should really think of doing it in honor of our brothers and sisters in Israel and all those that are captured and injured and fighting and so on and so forth, right? So I knew you were going to ask me examples, you see? No, I'm just kidding. So I was thinking of things that actually specifically have to do with protection and blessing, right? And again, for everyone, this is different, and everyone has their own sort of journey that they want to take. But mezuzah, for example, is one of them, right? So, for example, many, many people, so many Jewish houses have a mezuzah, but many Jewish houses only have mezuzah on the front door, right? I'd like to challenge everyone, if you only have mezuzah on the front door, add one more mezuzah, because the mezuzah should be on every door. If it's difficult, one more mezuzah. If you don't know how to get it, I'll get it for you. We actually don't do the mezuzah thing anymore here, but it's moved to a different office, but it's fine, I can still get them. Put up another mezuzah, an additional mezuzah. If you haven't checked your mezuzah in years, check them, make sure they're kosher, and so on. Another little challenge. We're coming up to winter now, right? One of the most beautiful mitzvot, we've talked about this before, of that bring light to the world is lighting Shabbos candles. But here's the challenge. In winter, there's a time, we've talked about this, right? There's times you're supposed to, in summer the challenge is not light them too early. In winter the challenge is not light them late. To light candles after the sun goes down really undermines the whole candle. Now, I'm not judging people's Shabbos observance, but if you're going to light Shabbos candles, they need to be lit properly. And lit properly means they must be lit before Shabbat comes in. Okay, so that's just a challenge for the winter, to make sure you light Shabbos candles on time. That's an example of something. The next one's for men. Start putting on tefillin maybe once a week. Tefillin, we know the Gemara tells us, brings protection. See, I haven't given you a new one yet, right? Maybe your challenge is to find a fifth son and bring him to the Seder. But the other thing is, of course, matters of generosity, chesed, right? Chesed to other people. But to do it in a way that it's hard, like either to volunteer, to give charity to people before Pesach that need help, and there are people, there's different funds around that. Making Pesach is very expensive. There are people that struggle. Taking on a new project, it could be something like reaching out to people that you're a bit uncomfortable reaching out to. Like, you know, we all have people that annoy us. And then it's about making up with someone, extracting a relationship, doing something that's out of our comfort zone, going out to help others, whatever that might look like. Or giving more tzedakah, whatever the case is, that also is something that can be uncomfortable and is a very, very important thing. If you're doing all those things already, then there's many mitzvot. You can talk to me afterwards. I'll give you some examples of there's many, many mitzvot that people could do that we're not doing, and you know that we could take upon ourselves. But I think the point I'm trying to make is, don't just do a symbolic thing. Don't just, you know, an empty chair. Like, an empty chair can mean many things. I mean, there can be many empty chair ideas, and they're all nice and all beautiful and they all mean well. But that's not what it's about. It's about tachlis. It's about doing something that is action, about implementation. It's about maybe this Pesach doing something that allows us to go out of our own Egypt, and particularly this Pesach doing it for those that are having a difficulty celebrating Pesach. And Hashem should help us that we should see the miracle even before Pesach. And we should go out of our own Egypt, and God should take us out of our collective Egypt, and we should have the redemption. We want to share one Chag Sameach again. We're not having... The next one will start on the 9th of May, Thursday 9th of May. I will...